Welcome to The Detail, a podcast by me, Katie Melua,
and me, Polly Scattergood,
where we talk about the nitty-gritty detail of writing songs. In this episode, we explore the environment and the space we work in as writers, why it matters and how to build the right atmosphere to work in. This week, we're so lucky to explore this topic with legendary composer Erilyn Wallen. Erilyn Wallen is an Ivor Novello Award winner. She has a CBE and recently worked on Jerusalem for 2020's Last Night of the Proms.
Welcome to The Detail. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, it's been lovingly made by me and Katie. The editing, however, has been done by me, Polly Scattergood, in my studio at home. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you'd like to hear more, receive additional content and the odd special treat sent directly from me to you, please head on over to my Patreon page to show your support. The address is patreon.com/Polly Scattergood. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Erilyn, welcome. It's such an honour to be speaking to you today. I've had so much fun delving into your archive and all of the incredible pieces that you've worked on. Something really jumped out at me when I was doing my research. In one interview, you described yourself as being an explorer when writing, and I thought this was such a beautiful way of describing the writing process and the space around you and the things that you're trying to discover. And I just wondered, how important when writing is location to you? Is it something that you think about much, or does it not come into your consciousness?
Well, Polly, that's such a good question. When I first started out as a composer, singer-songwriter, I had one rule for myself, which was that I should be able to write anywhere, in any condition, just so that I wouldn't be precious about things. But I have to say, since I've had The Lighthouse, I understand what it is to have absolute peace and quiet. And, you know, I've always been inspired by water, so I live there right on top of the sea. And I have to say, I can really get through, the Jerusalem I wrote in 3 weeks. And I just focused on that. And it just helped, you know, that I could wake up at any time, morning, day and night, and know that I could work undisturbed.
It just sounds so magical and tranquil. Erilyn, can you, for our listeners, describe what it's like in The Lighthouse so we can all immerse ourselves in your world for a minute or two?
Well, I actually just have half of this lighthouse, but it's quite an ugly sort of building. It's not one of the curly-whirly ones. Uh-huh. It was built in 1958. It's built right on a rock, the very north of Scotland. It's the third most northerly place in United Kingdom.
Wow.
Right. So looking out at sea, the next stop after due north is the North Pole. So that's how I'm very, very, it's extremely remote.
Wow.
Can be extremely windy, and the storms can be tremendous. We can have 90-mile-an-hour winds, and that in any for hour to hour the weather can change. But what is always constant is this massive sky, and I'm surrounded by the sea, and the sea itself is always changing. But inside is incredibly cozy. So outside there are rocks. It's quite, because it's so windy, there aren't really any, well, there were no trees. There's the sheep that graze there. I look out from one window and I can see Orkney on a clear day. There's a bleakness to it, but there's an enormous, you know, majesty of the sea. It's a very special place.
God, the description is just beautiful, Erilyn. Can I ask, were you actually looking for a perfect writing location in an actual lighthouse?
No. That's the funniest thing. I wasn't looking for a lighthouse, but I stumbled across it. There's a website called lighthousesforsale.co.uk. I found it there, but I was actually looking for an unusual place. And this was the criteria, a place that was right on top of the sea, mm-hmm. and a place where I could work without disturbing anybody. Nobody would hear me, so I could, you know, that way where you just want to bash away at mm-hmm. ideas and you don't want to feel self-conscious about it.
Yeah.
I wanted that. I don't get that in my London flat. So, and that's what I have in the lighthouse. So,
wow.
But I didn't sign up for a lighthouse, but it, having lived there, I can't imagine not living there.
people often sort of do field recordings and things like that, but how much do you think that the atmosphere of where you're writing goes into your work?
Oh, Polly, that's such a brilliant question, because I don't know if you're the same, but one of my first sensations, you know, as a baby, is being very aware of atmospheres, going to a room and either feeling tension between people or remembering the smell of a place, or, you know, before you could even speak, atmospheres what have always stayed with me. And mm-hmm. I would say that in my music, I'm always trying to create an atmosphere, and sometimes these atmospheres are remembered, but atmosphere's crucial. It's what I carry with me, actually. That's a massive inspiration to me. And so I'm always thinking about the feeling of spaces, you know.
And Erilyn, how do you find, you know, because I feel like every single detail that surrounds me when I'm working is of importance. Because I think it's to do with the fact that, you know, the best way of writing or the best feeling when I'm writing is when I'm kind of unaware of everything else. And so you're in this sort of subconscious state. But then you realize that, but you don't realize it, that there are, you know, something in the corner of your eye, like a painting you might have or a clock you might have, you know, in the sort of left-hand corner, is having an effect. So do you find that you have the same?
Yes. And that's a brilliant observation. I sometimes find it really hard to concentrate, but, you know, I will look at something. So in my little cottage in the lighthouse, I have quite a lot of contemporary art, and I particularly love the work of Howard Hodgkin. I have a print of his there, and I have some other contemporary art. But I made sure that I have things about me in the lighthouse that remind me that I must be connected to other people. It's not just a place to go and hide. So I have there's a Rauschenberg, you know, one of his sort of collage prints, and it somehow reminds me that we are in this world of contemporary concerns as well. So there's in that painting, there's Jeff Kennedy's pointing. There's it was obviously made in the 60s. There's a astronaut there to do with the moon landing. So I have things that are timeless, and so to me the sea is timeless, and I work looking out at the sea. And then I have things that remind me that actually I have a social responsibility in my work, that we are, all of us, we're witnesses to our time. So that's such a brilliant question, but when you're actually stuck in the work, as you say, Katie, you lose where you are, and none of it matters. You know, when you're stuck and you just don't know what to do, I look out at the sea and I think, look, the sea's always so busy. It's not stopping to think, oh, what should I go? Should I turn left or right? It's just busy being the sea. Mm-hmm. And so literally that we want to be in the flow with our work.
Yeah,
and
it
sometimes
keeps moving.
It's not easy. Mm.
That's just so beautiful, Erilyn. But you also talk about you're composing in such an interesting way. And I read somewhere that you said you try and make it an adventure for yourself, which sounds exactly like, you know, what you're doing with writing at the cottage in the lighthouse. There was a composition of yours around coal mining in South Wales. And so did you actually go to this coal mine, or did you do research in another way? Like, how did you capture the atmosphere of that?
The brief of that work was to write a work, a 50-minute oratorium, exploring the history of coal mining in South Wales, which, of course, is a vast topic. And so I spent some time with the writer John Binnis, and we spoke to ex-coal miners. We visited some mines.
Wow.
We spoke to geologists. We spoke to people involved. We did a lot of research. John did a tremendous amount of research. A bit like Jerusalem, a few people said, why am I, a person from Belize, composing music on this topic? And I suddenly thought, you know, I have to, let's approach it as if we were zooming into this village, but we're coming from outer space, and we gradually zoom in, and then we zoom in, and then we arrive at this house and these characters, and then we commence. And that helped me to write about something that is, you know, that I hadn't lived myself.
Talking of which, we cannot have this chat without me asking you about your incredible reworking of Jerusalem that you did for Last Night of the Proms. I mean, I watched it. I believe that all the greats who really sort of push things forward and change music and create conversation, you know, they're doing something different. And your reworking just started such incredible conversations up and down the country. You know, it was just such a beautiful thing. And you made it so exciting and new. And I was reduced to tears when I was watching it because it was so brave. It was something that it was imaginative. And I honestly never imagined that I would hear something like that on Last Night of the Proms on the BBC. It was just so moving. It blew my mind. What goes through your head when you sit down and begin to rework a piece like Jerusalem, steeped in so much history? What's going through your mind at that moment when you first begin?
When I was asked to do Jerusalem, thank goodness I didn't stop and think, oh my gosh, it's going to be television, it's Last Night of the Proms. I kept thinking, I must really be guided by the text of William Blake, and I must look at that poem again. Parry sets it in a very, it's the most fantastic hymn, fantastic music. But if I'm honest, it's got very little to do with the atmosphere of that text, which is so dark and searching and asking really difficult questions. You know, can we have grace in this land? Can we make a world that is really, a really good world and good world for everybody? Can we, you know, and I thought it's quite a dramatic text. So, and I didn't think, oh, what will I do? What will I do? I actually just let the text speak to me. And then I remember just going to the piano, and then there's that opening section, bang, it just popped out. And I like to think it wasn't me doing something to Jerusalem rather than the original text speaking to me and guiding me. Wow. So that made it easy.
There's a pause midway through Jerusalem, and hearing that ambience in that pause in the empty Albert Hall, it gave me shivers, and it, to me, it said more than words could ever say. And I kind of drew my own conclusions as a writer on your intention and the message that you kind of meant by adding that pause in. But can I ask, what was your reason for it? It was midway through the word Jerusalem, and then you stopped, and there was just this incredible kind of pause where the whole Albert Hall was just silent. So what was your reason for putting that pause so poignantly where you placed it?
Isn't it funny? I do these things. I think pauses, especially when you're working with massive forces, they cause us to stop up, we get pulled up short, don't we? We then have to concentrate. But I think the text does that. And so I think Golda Schultz was singing Jerusalem, but she sings Jerusalem. But it's reminding us what Jerusalem means, which is, oh my gosh, the great, the Holy Grail. And so first the pause is about, oh my gosh, I can barely say it. And then you say Jerusalem, but it's about thinking about the enormity of it. And that, you know, I don't mean to be eccentric in my words, but I just I often put things in that seem odd, and I didn't mean it to be funny, but it's more to really pay attention to what, you know, the enormity of that word, really.
That was the moment that really got me very emotional, because I thought it was such a reflective moment. It was just a couple of seconds, but it just was this pause where it was like, just think about what you're about to say kind of thing. And it just get the whole thing just, yeah, for me after that, I was just like, wow, this is quite incredible. So it's so interesting to hear that it was, you know, you were sort of taking your lead from the words and how they were kind of inspiring you to write. It's fascinating.
Thank you so much. And, you know, we had to rehearse that work in a socially distanced way. And Golda, the singer, didn't come until the Friday, and the Proms was on the Saturday. And so everybody was rehearsing separately. And we had a very good rehearsal on the Friday. And then after that, I remember saying to Golda and to everybody, can we make more of those pauses? Don't let's run through these pauses. The pauses are part of this music and the atmosphere as well. And, you know, silence is a scary place, isn't it, in music?
Erilyn, it just sounds so majestic. You also said at the start of this interview that, you know, you said very early on in your writing that you would be able to work anywhere. So was it just telling yourself that, or Have there been like tools that you've developed where if you're not in the perfect place, how you access that, you know, that atmosphere and that sort of state of mind to be able to work?
One can't always have the perfect conditions, and sometimes the imperfection comes from inside. We just may not feel like doing something. And so because I worked so many commissions, I had to find a way of just being able to write irrespective of the optimum conditions.
Talking of inspiring spaces, you made a film called Falling with Dan Fabaroff, Henriot Grieco and Steve McLean. Let's have a little listen to the piece of music you composed for that, and then let's talk a little bit about that. So do you know Steve well?
Steve actually took some of my CDs up into space with him, so that was so... But wow. He didn't tell me till after he'd come back from that mission. And
so you've had your work played in space?
Yes, yes. It's mad, it's so
not,
mad.
Not a bad gig.
Not a bad gig.
That's crazy.
Steve and I became friends. I'd been in Houston... some music was being played there, and I remember at the time I was writing opera about, I was making up this story about this astronaut going to Mars, and I said to Robert, who was organising the, Robert Avalon, who was organising the whole series of concerts, I said, oh, this is Houston, do you know any astronauts I could speak with? And he introduced me to Steve, and we became very, very, very close friends, and Steve was preparing for this mission, which actually kept being delayed. When he actually, as part of the mission, he did a spacewalk, and he, when he came back from that spacewalk, he, because he was able to email friends from space, can you believe that? And he emailed us, yeah, really, and he emailed all us all this, that entry for the day, and that entry for the day was why I loved it. It was full of the technical language of preparing, you know, preparing the suit for this, you know, spacewalk. And he had a job of work to do. They were fitting something onto the space station. And it's there in the film that he mustn't look down. His job is just to bolt something onto something else, a bit like a manual labourer. And then he looks down. And on the phone, even after, I would say, Steve, please describe to me again what it looks like to look down at Earth from space. And he himself could never get over that wonder. And so that he would talk a lot about being in the shuttle and what gravity. And he described how one night he would take off, you know, his belt, unstrap himself, and would just float around, but asleep, and float around. He did lots of little, his own personal experiments. And... yeah, and so that was a wonderful collaboration. And then we have a bit of Steve then speaking about that spacewalk, and then my song is sort of complementing further what he was saying. Mm-hmm. But I would say Steve McLean is possibly the most inspiring person I've ever met, because he feels so strongly that one of the things he said after that spacewalk, if I could take every five-year-old child up into space, they would never, ever want to damage our planet, because they'd see how beautiful the Earth is from space.
That's so inspiring and beautiful. I can see why a collaboration between the two of you, you know, works so well. If you had any words of wisdom for that you could share to with us and our listeners on how would you create the perfect writing space, either physically or spiritually, what would your advice be to people who want that space?
I do think that I actually come to the conclusion that absolute silence is the best starting place. Anything else, you've got to fight your way through a little bit. But as you said, Polly, that's sometimes no bad thing. But I do find silence is so delicious. And at the lighthouse, I wrap myself around it. And, you know, I don't seem to get lonely, really. I seem to get lonelier in a place that has sounds that I can't identify or coming from people I can't see. Real true silence is so restful, and it means you can really start to hear and you can think. But it's not always an easy place, you know, depending on your state of mind. Not everybody actually wants that. So I would say, some process in the writing, you know, somewhere on that timeline, give yourself absolute quiet. I don't think you need a room with lots of things in it. I know a composer that actually composes looking out onto a brick wall, but it's which is mad, isn't it? But I think it's the silence enables you to really somehow interrogate yourself. What I find with composing is that sometimes we forget the obvious things, and it's the obvious things that they're right in front of us. And so the silence enables you to just think, oh my gosh, that's so obvious, of course. And it allows, silence allows time for things to really occur and your mind to, you know, wander and just, you know, sit still with something. So I have also learned that it's okay to give yourself the things you need. So it's okay to give yourself silence. And it's not about having loads of money, but somehow trying to think about, each person's so different, trying to think about where you're happiest, most comfortable, and give yourself as much as that, really.
That's so, so beautiful. And the thing I love about what you just said is that actually silence is something that we all can access, isn't it? You know, it's open to every single person listening to this. We can all find somewhere that, you know, gives us that silence and that happy place. So it's been an incredibly inspiring speaking to you. And I'm going to hold your lighthouse in my heart today. It sounds so beautiful.
Erilyn, thank you so, so much. It's been an absolute honour, and we will keep that lighthouse with us.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, it's been lovingly made by me and Katie. The editing, however, has been done by me in my studio. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you'd like to hear more, receive additional content and the odd special treat sent directly from me to you, please head on over to my Patreon page to give your support. The address is patreon.com/PollyScattergood. Thanks so much.